I first met Niles when I first got sober, and it was up in Gainesville. When I was first getting sober, he was one of the guys that had something that I wanted. I'm so happy that he came down to share it with you. He's been sober since 94. Niles, please come up and fill in the blanks.
Hey, I'm Niles. I'm an alcoholic. And I wasn't nervous at all until Mike started the end of that story about how we got to share something y'all are going to want to hear and maybe somebody will want what I got and all that stuff. Now I'm scared to death. I'm going to say the wrong thing. I'm just kidding. I always get up and I say, you know, at my home group, because I get up a lot and I always think, you know, I always say, you know, I'm real nervous. And then I laugh and say, no, I'm not. But the reality is I'm always real nervous. I hope y'all are as nervous about this as I am, because that'll make me feel better. But I'm always nervous, but I learned in this program, you know, with fear to walk through it. And before I got here, fear controlled my life. If I was afraid of something, I would shut down and get locked down in that fear. After I got sober and had been sober for a while, I realized that the best way for me to deal with fear is to walk right through it, walk right into it. And that's what I've done for the past few years, you know, when I'm afraid of something. Like if I'm afraid to go in a place because I have a little social anxiety, you know, so if I'm afraid to go into a place by myself, you know, I get all my courage up and just bust through the door, you know, wide open. People probably look up and go, what's wrong with this guy, you know, but that's how I deal with fear, you know. I got to walk through it and I've got to deal with it. I can't hide from it and run from it anymore, so I'll just let y'all know I'm scared, I'm nervous about being up here, but I prayed before the meeting, and asked God to talk through me, so hopefully I'll say something y'all need to hear. If not, I'll say something I need to hear. So I don't take notes, so I don't have any notes, but I'm going to put my phone up here so I can see what time it is. I was joking, I've got a bunch of friends that came with me, my sponsor and my wife and a couple of good friends of mine. And I told them I was just going to tell a drunkalog until about 9:05 and then say, and then I got sober. Because I've seen it like that. But the reality is that I've been sober a lot longer than I drank now. You know, and so as far as drunkalogs, you know, I don't really tell a lot of them. I can tell some stories. I've got some, but there's just three drinks I'll probably tell you about. I've been sober for 18 years, and I got sober when I was 9. No, I'm just kidding. I got sober when I was 28, and I went to my first meeting when I was 15, and I needed to be there. I was mandated. I went in to the Hawk Club in Gainesville and sat down and listened and heard people talking about drinking cases of scotch and stuff, a bunch of old people sitting around. And I thought, man, you know, I probably need to be here, but I can't stay. So I hung around a couple months, did my little deal, and then I was back out. The one thing that did for me was that I realized at that time I was an alcoholic. So for the next few years, I drank, and I knew I shouldn't. I drank, and I was ashamed I was drinking. I drank, and I tried to hide the fact that I was drinking. And I'd sit there and tell you, I'm an alcoholic, you know, but I'm sure y'all have seen people do that drunk, tell you they're an alcoholic. But it wasn't until I accepted that fact, you know. I mean, I knew it, but I was still trying to figure out ways to beat it, and didn't want to, you know, accept it. I wanted to find a way to drink successfully. And from the first time I drank, I never found it. I never drank successfully. I didn't start out, you know, drinking all socially and then cross that line, because when you're 12, people aren't drinking, you know. So there was no social drinking for me. At that time, my friends at school that knew it were freaked out by it and scared of it. And, you know, I hung out with my brother's friends. I had an older brother, and they just thought it was cool. They thought I was cute, you know. And so I was looking at this singleness of purpose thing, and there's a lot of things that I did, you know, that weren't alcohol, because I would do anything you put in front of me, because I so desperately wanted to change the way I felt inside, that I would do any drug, anything, anything. It's the only thing I wasn't scared of. And but alcoholism is my thing. You know, I could always walk away from the drugs, and I could always put them down, and as long as I had alcohol. And so I guess I'm qualified. The I was born in Decatur, and my dad worked at General Motors, and he was an old country boy from Gainesville that moved up here to work at General Motors, and my mom was she was from Dahlonega, and they got down here in the 60s, and he continued to be an old country boy working at General Motors, and she really grabbed a hold of the hippie life and all that stuff, so they didn't last long. I think I was 3 when they got divorced, but I have memories of their fights and stuff. The first drink that, and I swear I was thinking about this, I think I remember it, but it's probably just me remembering being told about it, was when I was a toddler, and my dad had a drink sitting on the coffee table, and I grabbed it and started drinking it, and he had to fight me to get it away from me. And that pretty much set a precedent right there, because people did a lot of fighting trying to take alcohol away from me from then on. The second significant drink of mine was when I was 9. My mom was having a party, and I watched somebody mix a screwdriver, so I went in there, and when nobody was in the kitchen, I mixed me a screwdriver, you know, started drinking it. Man, I liked it. And later on, when my mom realized what I was doing, she started fighting me, trying to take it away from me. But I got enough in me to get real good and drunk, and threw up in the bed, and she spent half the night having to clean me up, and I just thought that was so cool, you know. I just thought, yeah, you know, this is awesome. And like I said, and then when I was about 12, my brother was 16, and his friends were all partying, so I was hanging out with them, and I started drinking as much as I could, because the way I always drank, you know, I felt, I said I didn't cross the line, you know, I'm sure I was born an alcoholic, because I always had those feelings of, you know, not being quite good enough, insecurities, fear, and stuff like that. So when I found alcohol and started drinking it on a regular basis, it took all that fear and insecurity away temporarily. And so when I started drinking, I drank as much as I could get in me. And that was my goal, was to drink as much as I could get, as fast as I could get it in me. And later in life, when I decided, you know, well, I need to go out and just have a couple of drinks and get a buzz, I never could, because I drank so much and so fast that I always just went right past the good stuff, straight to the, you know, falling down, sloppy, stupid, drunk, blacking out, passing out. And that's the way I always drank. So there's really no glamorous stories about my drinking. You know, it was all unsuccessful drinking. It was always to passing out, you know, or whatever, and then waking up the next morning trying to figure out where I was at and how I got there, and whatever situation I may be in. I'm sure y'all know what I'm talking about, waking up the next morning wondering where my car was at, or wondering how I got where I'm at, or wondering where my shoes were at, or wondering, you know, which jail I was in. It was always something. It was always a bad ending. So, the third most significant drink I ever had was when I was about 25, and I was trying to get sober at the time, because I'd already had my 2 DUIs, and I'd already been, you know, through the court system and everything, and had been trying to get sober, but I was working night shift and living at these little rent-by-the-week cabins on Lake Lanier, and I got home one morning, and everybody was out there. The cabins were in like a horseshoe, and everybody down there was at their end of the road like I was, and they were partying. So I got home from work that morning, and they were already out. It was like a Saturday or something, so I stayed up and started drinking, and drank all day, and about 10:30 I realized, well, I got to get ready and go to work tonight, and I hadn't been to bed. So I went in and took a shower, jumped in my car and took off, and going down Highway 20 towards 400, I didn't black out that night like I usually did when I drove. So I remember the whole drive, and I couldn't keep my car in my lane. I couldn't stay in my lane. I was crossing the center line. I was running off the road all the way for like 45 minutes till I got to work. And I was working off of 400 off McFarland. So I pulled into my job and pulled up in the parking lot and threw up and passed out right there with my door open. And Slept in the car till about 2:30 in the morning. And finally, I woke up, went into work, and and luckily, my boss, you know, I was in the printing industry for 16 years. My boss was a drunk too, so he was like, "Man, you look like crap." And I was like, "I know." He's like, "Well, you know, go on to work. What happened to you?" And I said, "Well, I passed out in the car, and y'all should have woke me up when you were coming in." And joked about it and joked it off and went to work. And the reason that's so significant for me is because that's the last time I drove drunk, because I'd always blacked out, and I always drove in a blackout, and I've driven drunk so many times. And only one time had an issue, and that's I ran over a guy one night drunk, but that's, you know, I didn't kill him, thank God. So I took him to the hospital, and I got out of that one. But that last time, I remember the whole trip. And it was like God revealing to me, this is what it's like when you drive drunk. You know, you're all over the road, and you could kill somebody. So that was it. I didn't drive drunk again, and it was pretty shortly after that that I got sober. Because it just scared me to death. You know, I mean, we're in blackout. We don't remember, so it doesn't scare us. It's just like people tell us what we did. We piece it together or whatever. But knowing was real scary. So, like I said, I was about 25 then. I was 26 when I really came into the program. And because I'd had a couple of DUIs, and I had been married and been divorced, I had a son. And when he was about 6 months old, I came home one night about 3 or 4, 5 o'clock in the morning drunk, and brought a buddy from work home, and my wife was gone. And she had taken my son with her. And she'd been threatening to leave, and I didn't really believe her, you know, because she never left. And so I continued to, you know, I feel so bad about that marriage because I drank through it, you know, and drank that marriage away. And she was a pretty good person. She didn't really deserve to have to live with one of us, but she did, until she couldn't take it anymore, and she left. And that had a pretty big impact on me because of my son, you know. And so I went out. And for the next several months, I'd say 6 months after that, was my last bender, you know. I went, had an opportunity to go to New Orleans with my job, so I did. And I don't know if any of y'all ever been to New Orleans, but that's the drinkingest place in the world. And I was in trouble down there, and I knew it right off the bat because there was so much drinking and so much alcohol, and it's 24 hours a day. And I'm from Georgia, man. We didn't have alcohol on Sundays, you know, unless we went to the bootlegger, which I knew where they were. But down there, I drank so much, you know, that I'd went down there to help this office out. I had this sales job, and I'd gone to help this office out, but they almost fired me while I was down there because I was out of control down there. My wife had just left me, and I was young and drunk and in New Orleans, and it was insane. So I was down there for 3 months and could not wait to get out of that town. And I did. I left there and went to Jackson, Mississippi. And that's where got my keys. That's where I found my bottom, was in Jackson, Mississippi. I was working for this sales company, and they had set us up to where me and four other guys, they rented us a house and we lived in it, and they paid all our bills. We just had to show up to work and work enough to make enough to drink that night, you know, and had no responsibility. And I fell into that pattern of coming to every morning and swearing that I wasn't going to drink anymore. And I know we've all been there, or most of us, you know, not even knowing how I got drunk the night before, swearing I wasn't going to drink anymore. That was it, you know, praying to God to please help me and trying to figure out a different way to live. But I just had to pull it together enough to go in the office, and then I was out on the road on my own, and by 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, I was just, you know, standing there with a drink in my hand. And sometimes like a drunk dream, you know. I didn't go in there to buy a drink, but there I was with that drink in my hand, and once it was in me, there was no stopping until the end. So I was out there for about 6 months, or 5 or 6 months, and I had to come back here for a DUI that I had been putting off. And So I decided that when I came back here for that DUI, I was going to leave everything there. I was going to come back here and get sober because I knew I had to do something. And I guess I didn't realize maybe they had AA in Jackson, Mississippi. I was going to come back to Georgia and do my DUI thing and get sober. So I did. And when I got back here, you know, I joke about it. I had that drunk car. You know, every corner was beat up. It was old Crown Victoria Ford. And everything I owned was in the back seat, you know. But I didn't want to admit that my life was unmanageable, you know. And I came back here and started trying to get sober. And I was going to a meeting in Gainesville. And my cousin went to that meeting. And a couple times a week I was going in there. And I needed this program so bad that I would just sit in that meeting and cry. You know, when I first came in, I would just sit in there and cry. And after about 2 weeks in that meeting, I got a DUI on a Saturday night. And in Gainesville, when you get a DUI, they put your name in the paper and, you know, report it and everything. And I walked back in that meeting on a Tuesday, and I was hoping nobody had seen the paper, you know. And they were like, a couple of guys were grinning when I walked in, and they're like, "We saw your name in the paper," you know. And I was like, great, you know, they're going to kick me out. That's it. AA's done with me, you know. I've been kicked out of better places than this. They said, "That's all right. We love you anyway. Just keep coming back." And that's when I realized that this is where I belong, you know. Because every place I'd ever tried, every organization I'd ever tried, I've been through treatment 3 times, you know. Did long-term treatment when I was a teenager. I did the Hall County mental health thing. I got kicked out of all that stuff. And AA didn't kick me out. Hadn't kicked me out yet. So no matter what I do, even when I drank, they didn't kick me out. So I realized that I belong here. And I've been coming ever since, you know. It took me about 3 or 4 more months to quit drinking. But from what I've been told, that's okay, you know. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I had the desire, I just couldn't figure out how to do it, you know. So I kept coming and kept going to meetings. And finally, quit drinking, you know. Moved down to Smyrna. And my dad had just graduated from Ridgeview. He's an alcoholic. I guess I should have mentioned that earlier, but my dad's an alcoholic, of course. Everybody, my family's an alcoholic. And my dad had just graduated from Ridgeview, so I went down there and moved in with him and started getting sober and really, you know, quit drinking and really started working at it. And at that time, I was willing to do anything, you know. The drinking was, I was so desperate with desperately wanting something better, that I was willing to do anything except for work steps or read the big book or work with a sponsor. I was just going to sit in meetings and sit in the back and listen to what y'all had to say and get sober, you know. And some of y'all might think that works, and some of you probably know it doesn't. It doesn't work. That we can't get sober by osmosis, but I sat in there. And people kept saying, you need to get a sponsor. So I got a sponsor. And people said, you need to work the steps. So I worked the steps, you know, 1, 2, 3. I worked the first step, second step, third step. And then my sponsor started nagging me, wanting me to work that fourth step. I really didn't want to do that because that fourth step was scary. And I did read it, and it said, if, you know, it starts making you uncomfortable, just put it down. So I put it down and continued to be miserable. And when my sponsor would start getting after me about doing, you need to do this fourth step, I'd just quit talking to him. And then I'd find me another sponsor. And then I'd work the first step and second step and third step. And I did that for about 18 months. And of course, after 18 months, I May 7th, 1994, I went out to the lake with a friend of mine, and then I went, it was Mother's Day, and I went and found my stepmother, who I thought was the devil most of my life, and at 18 months sober, I made amends with her. I thought that's what I needed to do, and I'd only worked 3 steps, but I need to make amends with my stepmother. And I did, and it actually went pretty well. And then that afternoon, I had a very traumatic experience with my ex-wife, who was just my girlfriend at the time, and drank that day. Because it says that sooner or later we'll come to that point where there's nothing between us and a drink except for our, you know, spiritual program. And I didn't have it. I didn't have a spiritual program. And caught my ex-wife in a hotel with somebody she shouldn't have been with, and I drank that day. Because that moment came, and it's not her fault, you know, it's my fault, because I didn't have that spiritual program. And so I grabbed a beer, and I drank half a beer, and it scared me to death. And I really did not want to drink again, so I took that half a beer, and I jumped back in my car, and I went home. And went to my house, and I sat down in the living room, and I sat that half a beer on the coffee table, you know, and sat there by myself and thought, I blew it. I guess I'll go ahead and drink, you know. Go ahead and tie one on good. And that was my line of thinking at the time, and somebody knocked on the door, and it was another alcoholic. Because, you know, I'd just been hanging around the rooms, but I was hanging out with sober people. And another alcoholic knocked on my door and said, what's going on? And I said, well, let me tell you. So he went with me, and we poured the rest of that beer out, talked about what was going on. And that night I went to a meeting and picked up a white chip. And that's the last drink I ever had. And when I went in that meeting, it was over in Marietta, or over in, like, I don't know, on that extension up there at the hospital I used to go to. And I picked up my white chip on a Sunday night, and man, this guy pitched a fit. This guy in the meeting threw a fit. He's like, you need to go to your home group and pick up that white chip. You don't need to be coming in here picking it up. This is not your home group. And I thought, well, I'll just leave then. But instead, I sat there and listened to the rest of the people in the group just bust his ass the rest of the meeting about saying that. Because, you know, I don't care where you got to go. When you need a white chip, you need a white chip. You know, my home group didn't meet until Tuesday, and I needed that white chip Sunday. So I got it, and got a lot of support about it. And I decided that I should probably try to work the program so I could build up that, you know, defense against that drink. So I set out with all these good intentions, and again, didn't work the steps. And didn't get in the big book like I should, and didn't use a sponsor like I should, and didn't do anything except sit in the back, and every once in a while I'd share, but people, I used to get pissed off because nobody had asked me to be their sponsor, you know. Because I'm going to tell you, I didn't work the steps, and I don't recommend this to anybody, but I didn't work the steps until I had 5 years in this program. I was 5 years away from a drink, and I was considering suicide because I didn't want to drink. And I was so miserable because I was suffering from untreated alcoholism that I was considering I wasn't going to drink, I was going to kill myself. That's what finally got me to work the steps. But before I did, and I had 5 years, and I used to think, well, I can't share about how messed up I am or how miserable I am, because that'll show the newcomer that I've been in here 5 years and it's not working, you know. So I can't let them see that, so I just need to sit here and keep my mouth shut. So I just sat there in my misery, you know, and I learned in that I have to take however I'm feeling, I have to go to a meeting with it. You know, I have to talk to my sponsor, I have to take it to a meeting, I have to share honestly and openly, or else this program cannot work in my life. Because if I'm sitting in the corner with my mouth shut, looking pissed off, you know, nobody wants what I've got anyway. You know, and it's a lot better for me to be sharing. Like, I've got 18 years and I still have days, you know, where I need to go to a meeting and share about my day. And what that actually shows people, I think, and when I hear people share about their day, what I'm seeing is that somebody's in a meeting sharing about their day instead of out there drinking about it. And that's where I've got to think, and that's where I've got to be, and that's what I try to do. At that point, that jumping off point I was talking about earlier, where I at 5 years, something told me when I was sitting on the edge of that bed thinking about ending it. Something said, you know, you just need to get some help, you know. And so I called my EAP rep at work, and I told them what was going on. We have a 24-hour phone line, you know, and I told them what was going on, and they're like, all right, we're going to have somebody call you. Just sit still, be, you know. And I said, all right. So I got on the phone with what was then my sponsor that I just never talked to. I called him, and I made him stay on the phone with me until they called me back, and he did. And they called me back, and they sent me to a psychiatrist, you know, like they should have. And so I went and see the psychiatrist, and I thought, you know, I got nothing against outside help. If we need it, you know, that's what we need. So I went to the psychiatrist, and I met with her, and I talked to her, and I told her what was going on with me and how I was feeling and what was going on in my life and what my thinking was like. And she stopped me after about 15 minutes and said, hang on a minute. I said, all right. She said, I'd like to get you on medication and recommend you to, you know, just some treatment right immediately. And I said, all right. If that's what you think I need, that's what we'll do. But all I'm asking is let's, you know, have a couple sessions first, and then we'll see. She said, all right. So we did. And so I met with her. She wasn't a psychiatrist. She was a counselor. I met with this counselor and had a few sessions with her. And in the meantime, my sponsor had passed away right after that. And I got a new sponsor and decided that I should probably work the steps. You know, if there's one thing I hadn't tried is working the steps. So started seeing this counselor, and I got my sponsor, who's sitting over here, and started working the steps. And when we got to that fourth step, and I started getting to that point where, you know, it's time to put this thing down. It's getting a little uncomfortable. This guy pushed me and said, you know, let's set a date and let's get that fourth step done, and we'll do the fifth step. And if it gets uncomfortable, that's all right. Just go ahead and get through it. And I did. I worked the fourth step. And then I worked the fifth step. And I went over to his house and I did my fifth step with him. And we sat in his basement. And I told him all my secrets that I thought were so big and bad that I'd never told anybody. The things that haunted me that I thought were so bad, you know, that I had to keep them to myself. And I shared them with him. And his kids were home. And he let me stay in his house, even after I shared all that with him. And I thought, you know. And then I went home and I did what it said to do. And I immediately, you know, thought about the fifth step and thought about whether or not I'd done it thoroughly. And I did the sixth and seventh step. And my untreated alcoholism went away, you know. And I never even, I mean, you know, it sounds hokey, just work the steps and go to meetings. But the whole power of this program for me is in these steps. And when I am not working the steps, my ass is in trouble. It's easy as that. You know, I'm not an alcoholic because I drank too much. I didn't drink myself into alcoholism. You know, my alcoholism's in my mind. And I'm wired a little bit different. And I'm, you know, I was joking with them earlier on the way over here. We stopped at REI because we got here real early because I'm obsessive about being places early. And they're like, we got an hour. So we pulled in REI and walked around. And I said, you know, I was going to get up here and I was going to say, we're supposed to tell what it was like, what happened and what it's like now. But I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about my feelings, you know. Because I'm a sensitive guy, you know. And before I got here, you know, my life was so tragic. My childhood was tragic. My life was tragic. I didn't go into all that. But my father's an alcoholic. My stepmother was abusive physically. And I grew up with a very poor self-esteem. And I always blamed them. I blamed my stepmother. And I blamed because she was so friggin' mean. And she just hated me, you know. And so I blamed her. And I was a victim, and that was I brought that into my adulthood, you know, being a victim. And you know, so I joke about being sensitive, but the reality is I'm real sensitive, you know. And my feelings get hurt pretty easy, and I lash out, and I act bad when my feelings get hurt. So I have to not to stay on top of my game in this program. I've got to go to meetings. I go to at least 3 a week is what works good for me. You know, I like to do more. If I just do 2, which happens sometimes because life is busy now, then I get a little edge about me. But if I make my 3 meetings, you know, I'm good. And I stay in the book, and I talk to my sponsor on a regular basis, and he tells me all the time, you know, if I'm going through something, he's like, well, do an inventory. And I'm like, you know, because I still want to resist that, doing that inventory and finding my part. But that 4th and 5th step took away that whole victim thing, you know, of my parents and my raising and everybody treating me bad. And, you know, I had a part in all that. And I had to find that part, and I had to clean up my side of the street on that deal, and I did. And once I did that, then I couldn't blame that anymore. And I remember when I was about 25, we were having a conversation at work one day, and this guy was saying, man, these people just blaming their parents for everything, you know, they need to get over it and grow up and take responsibility for their own, you know, actions and everything. And boy, it made me mad. I was like, you just don't understand, you know. Some of us really did have it bad when we were young, you know. Some of us really are victims, and it really made me mad. But after I worked that 4th and 5th step, that went away, and I'm like, yeah, you know, my dad's an alcoholic. I never really resented him. You know, he was my hero. He just got drunk every 3 or 4 weeks and disappeared for 3 or 4 days at a time, you know. My stepmother was mean. She was a mean person, and she treated me badly, but, you know, she had her own issues. She had her own demons, and she was doing the best she could. You know, and I'm so grateful I made amends with her when I did and continued that amends, because she killed herself about, what, 4 or 5 years ago? She never put her demons down, you know. She just wrote it all the way out. And she knew help was available, but she didn't take it. And I was able to go to her funeral. You know, took my sponsor, went to her funeral, sat in the back, and saw her off, you know, and no hard feelings, because I'd made those amends with her, and that was a powerful thing for me. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, the answer to everything that I've got going on today is in these steps. And I go to a meeting every Thursday night, and part of the before the meeting reading is share what's going on with you as it pertains to alcoholism or whatever, you know. And I'm like, everything that goes on with me pertains to alcoholism, because I'm an alcoholic. And the way I react to things is because I'm an alcoholic, you know. And I get resentful about something. I don't just get resentful towards a person. I get resentful towards them and everybody around them and their family, you know, and any business they may be affiliated with. And I resent it all. And they don't even know. And they're like, what's wrong with this guy? Because I'm acting out on them, you know, all of them. And they're like, gosh, this guy's an asshole. But that's just the way I'm wired, and that's what my resentment does. So I can't afford it, you know, because I really act badly. So what I have to do today when I start getting them is I have to pray. I do a lot of praying. And I've been in this program, you know, a good long while. And I went married and divorced in this program. And that second divorce was so hard, because the first divorce, I blamed it on my alcoholism. It's my fault, I'm a drunk, you know, and I apologized and made amends to her. And we moved on. I got a beautiful son from it. I got to raise him because she couldn't. And when I was about 6 months sober, he came to live with me. And he's moving out next week. He's 22. And he's a wonderful kid. And but I got married and divorced in this program. And the second divorce was a little bit harder, because I couldn't blame it on my drinking. So I really had to look at myself and some of my behaviors. And the reality is I was still behaving badly, and still do sometimes. You know, I have to continue to work the program. I have to continue to work the steps. I have to stay in the book. I have to keep from, you know, letting my default come back, which is sensitive and resentful and all that stuff, you know. And it's no way to live. So I do. I stay in the program. And after that divorce, well, a good deal after that divorce, about 5 years ago, I started going to Al-Anon. And went for a couple of years, and I say it's like the graduate program for AA because AA is so good, and it's done me so much good. But when I got in that other room, it taught me how to act a little better. It taught me how to say no without resentment. It taught me how to treat other people and how to be in a successful relationship, because when I got divorced, and I was single for better than 10 years in this program, and I you know, I didn't know how to be in a relationship, so I just stayed single. And I used to really work hard to try to be the kind of person I needed to be to attract the kind of person that I'd want to be with. And that's kind of the goal I set, and I strive for it. And Al-Anon took me a long way with that. And now I'm remarried. And I said I would never do it. And I told her, you know, I probably wouldn't do it. And I really meant that. With everything I had, I was going to be single, man. I wasn't going to do it anymore. And but, you know, we should never say never, because, you know, things happen. And God, I swear, put the perfect person in my life. Not an alcoholic. You know, not even a heavy drinker. And it's amazing, you know. We went to high school together. Before I got kicked out. I got kicked out in ninth grade. And twice. And then dropped out. And then, you know, but thank God I graduated in long-term treatment. That's where I graduated high school. But I knew her in the ninth grade. Just surface level stuff. And we hooked up at a we ran into each other at a party, and then eventually we hooked up. And when we run into our friends that we know from high school, because Facebook, you know, it's a wonderful thing for making amends, because you find everybody on Facebook, and, you know, everybody you went to school with, some people you don't want to find. But people ask us, how in the world does Niles Wilson wind up with Debbie Buffington? Because she was such a good person, and I was such a not a good person. And so it's working out real well, because I'm a lot better person now than I was back then, and because of this program. I grew up in this program, and about, you know, it's funny, he said something about God, and I had a real issue with God when I came in here, like a lot of us do. You know, I'd been to church a little bit when I was a kid, just enough to really think the preacher was talking to me, you know, and I was the one going to hell, and I figured, you know, screw it. Now, there's no way I can satisfy God. So I walked away from all that, you know, as a teenager, and carried a resentment towards religion for years. And when I came in here and I heard people talk about God, I'd cringe up a little bit, you know. But and then later, I used to think, man, we probably shouldn't talk about God so much in here, because it's going to run out the newcomer. And then I'd think, well, hell, I was a newcomer, and people talked about God, but I needed to be here so bad that they weren't going to run me out with it. I just, you know, didn't like it much. And so it's okay. But I've had several different spiritual experiences in here. You know, the first one, and I remember it hit me like a brick in the face, you know, when I realized that thy will be done in that prayer we say at the end, what it really meant, because I always said it, you know, thy will be done. And one day I realized that I was talking about God's will in my life, and it was like, wow, you know, that's pretty powerful right there. And then I've had several different spiritual experiences in this program. You know, I learned, you know, right around when I worked the steps, that when people say I get on my knees, they're not talking about going down 85 running 80 miles an hour at 6:30 in the morning. They're talking about hit your knees, you know, before you leave the house. Turn your will and your life over to God. And I started doing that. You know, I started getting on my knees, like really on my knees. And I do that every morning. And I've done it every morning for years. And it makes my life so much better. Because when I'm in control, I can drive it straight in the ground, you know. But when I'm, when my higher power is in control, my life is good, you know, and things work out. Things work out good. And so, just a couple of years ago, I have a 17-year-old daughter, and like I said, I've got that 22-year-old son, and we never went to church or anything like that because I had those issues, my issues, and so I never exposed them to church. And you know, they're good kids, so it's fine, but my daughter got exposed to church somehow on her own and started going. And she got saved and stuff, and I was like, well, that's good, you know, and but it's not for me. And then she started singing at her little church over there, so I wanted to go hear her sing because I'm proud of my daughter and I love her. So, you know, I went over there and listened to her sing. And then there's this youth pastor at her church that's, he's a young guy, he's like 35, 36, and he showed a big interest in my daughter, and I thought that was pretty cool, and I started watching this guy, and I couldn't see how he was a hypocrite, like I thought all people at church were hypocrites, you know, they just talked that stuff, and then they went home and drank and beat their kids, and it's not the case, you know, he was like living what he was talking, so I thought he was all right, and he's a real nice guy, so I was kind of happy about my daughter being in church, and then he went and took a pastor job at this church, and my daughter started going over there, so I said, well, I'm going to go over there and listen to him a little bit. So I did, and I got involved in church a couple of years ago, and it was just one of them things that another resentment that I was able to put down, and I've been going to church pretty regular, well, real regular, you know, three times a week now. And this guy, he sent me a text on the way over here. I invited him to come down here, you know, because I wanted him to hear my story, and he sent me a text on the way down here. He couldn't make it because his son had a banquet or something, but he sent me a text. And that's, you know, and that's cool. And I can tell you that my life in the past 2 years with the program, because I've always been one to say, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is what we've got to have, you know. And I've seen people come in here and get sober and then say, all right, I'm going to church. And I never see them again. And it scares me to death for them because I think, and I've always thought, you know, we need to be in here. This is where we get what we need because we have the open forum. We share our experience, strength, and hope with each other. And that's where the miracle of this program is. And they don't do that in church, you know. They sit up there and this one guy talks to them, you know, down there. And but I had a misconception, you know. And now I've got my program, and that's where I get my sobriety at, you know, and that's where I get all the good stuff, and that's what got me where I need to be. And I got church too, and it's a dual action thing, you know. And I can tell you, my life has gotten so much better over the past couple of years. You know, God's put this wonderful woman in my life that's just, you know, way beyond what I deserve from where I come from, you know. And never even thought, you know, I didn't think there was any good women left. Sorry, but that's just, you know, I've had some crazy ones in my life, and I never thought there were good ones left, and there is, and it's amazing. And in this program, from when I came in, when I was 28 years old, and I had the mentality of about a 12-year-old, you know, I was just pitching fits all over the place, and full of rage and anger and miserable, and couldn't even hardly see how life was worth living, you know. And then I've grown up in here, you know. And now I feel like a grown-up. I feel like a 40-year-old, you know. I'm fixing to turn 47, and that kills me because I'm getting old. And I dread getting old. I look at my sponsor and I think, my God. No, I'm just kidding, Mark. I dread it, but I've grown up in here. And that's because, you know, I'm willing to do what I need to do now. And when I came in, I was just a stubborn kid pitching fits and wasn't going to do this and wasn't going to do what y'all said. And I've worked the steps. And now I sponsor people. You know, I had a sponsee that was going to come with me, but he couldn't because he had to work late. And that's cool. You know, I would love to have had him with me. But, you know, it's a true fact that to keep this thing, we got to give it away for fun and for free. you know, not with any expectations. And, you know, it was a real powerful experience when I did my fifth step with my sponsor. One of the most powerful experiences of my life. But when I had a guy share his fifth step with me, blew me away. You know, and that's where the program's at, you know, experience, strength, and hope. We share with each other, and there's nothing I've ever walked into an AA meeting and said was going on with me that somebody hadn't been through it. And thank God people are willing to come share that stuff, you know. So I try to share, you know, several years ago, my ex-wife was going to take my daughter, who was 4, and move off to Canada, over on the west coast of Canada, up, God, crazy, British Columbia up above, like higher than Alaska even. It's like 3,500 miles away. And I begged her to not take my daughter away because I was, you know, it was like losing my daughter because I was like, I can't afford to go over there and get her. I'm never going to see her again. So I went through this whole big thing. I went to my meeting that night and I shared about these homicidal tendencies I was having. I was thinking I was going to kill my ex-wife and be done with it. Told her mother, you're probably going to be raising Chelsea because I'm going to kill your daughter. And she said, that's probably not a good idea. And it wasn't. There's been times, though, recently where I've thought, man, if I'd have done it then, I'd have been out of jail by now. She'd be gone. But you just have to know my ex-wife to understand that story. But anyway, but I didn't. And then I went to the meeting the next night and shared how I felt. And I went to the meeting the third night and shared how I felt. And I went to the meeting the fourth night and shared how I felt. And on that fourth night, a guy walked up to me after the meeting, a good friend of mine now, and said, I've been through that exact same thing. His wife had took his daughter to Seattle, which was just a jump stop from where my daughter was going. And he said, I thought it was the end of my world. And here's what I did to stay sober when that happened. And if you can figure out a way to turn this over to your higher power, everything else in this program is going to be a cakewalk. And he talked to me for about an hour and a half about it. And he was right. Because I thought it was too big. And I used to have this running list of things that are too big for God, too big for sobriety. If this happens, I'm not going to be able to stay sober. If this happens, there's no way I can stay sober. That was one of them. And I stayed sober. Thank God, because that guy took me outside the meeting. Mark R. And he shared that experience with me that he had gone through. And I saw him sober, and I figured if he can do it, I can do it. And I've seen people go through. I've knocked out that whole list by watching people go through it. You know, watching people lose children and stay sober. It's amazing watching people lose spouses, watching people lose parents, watching people lose their home, watching people lose lots of money here recently, you know, and staying sober. And it's amazing. And I figure if they can do it, I can do it. I tell my son all the time, he tells me a lot, you're right, Dad, I should have listened to you. He went out and bought a BMW. He's 22. He went out and traded his Jeep for a BMW, and he said, and he's still living with me, and he said, I'm going to trade my Jeep for a BMW. And I said, he said, what do you think about that? And I said, I don't think that's a very good idea. And he said, well, but it's got twin turbos on it, and it's this and that. And I said, yeah. I said, well, you're not going to be living with me for the next 5 years while you pay that car off, so I don't know if it's a good idea. And he said, well, what if I told you my mind's made up? And I said, well, okay. Then you do what you got to do, and we'll see how it works out. Well, that was a year ago. And he just told me the other night, because he's moving out, and he doesn't know how he's going to pay his rent. I wish I wouldn't have done that, Dad. And I said, yeah, I know. And I was the same way. But as an alcoholic in this program, I learned lessons by watching other people walk through stuff that I think, you know, I could never walk through and stay sober. So I'm not like that kid anymore that's got to go out there and find out by myself. You know, I can watch y'all go through it. I can hear y'all share about it. And I can say, man, that's, you know, now I don't have to go out and try that, you know. And that's a miracle, you know, because I used to be pretty hard-headed too. And so, you know, that's why I just tell my son, I know. I know. You're right, Dad. I'm like, yeah, I like hearing it. But in this program now, you know, I mean, I get my experience from y'all. You know, I mean, there's still things I have to go out and do on my own and learn my lessons, you know, but it's been quite a ride, and you know, I just I pray every day that I stay in here, and I intend on doing what I need to stay in here, and that's go to meetings, keep working the steps, stay in the big book, work with other people, give it away, and just so y'all know, there's a movie coming out Friday called Flight. Yeah, and I'm in it. So y'all go see it, and they had an AA meeting in it. We went down and did this extra stuff. Me and some buddies of mine from AA got a call, and we went down, and we sat in an AA meeting while they filmed that movie. We were in the room with Denzel Washington all day. Yeah, that was cool. You're not supposed to talk to him, but I did anyway. So we're all going to see the movie Friday night, and I'm going to take me some sunglasses. I hope I'm in it. Yeah, I hope I'm in it, you know. I had a black eye, so they got me up. I think my black eye is going to serve me well in that when I got hit with a softball. But it's about all I got. I appreciate y'all letting me come down and share my story. And it's funny, I'm not nervous at all now, so I could probably talk for another hour or two. But it's been a good experience for me, and I appreciate it. Thank y'all.
Thank you, Niles, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. You know, I could really relate to one thing that you talked about that really made all the difference to me was those steps. The answer to everything is in those steps. You know, whatever peace of mind and serenity that I've got in my life today has come from working those steps. I mean, the answer to everything is in those steps. So, you know, I fiddled around a lot, didn't do them, always wound up going back out and drinking. But once I worked my way through those steps, man, things started getting a lot better. And, you know, I do have some peace of mind and serenity today, but it's all from working those steps. So, got to work them steps, man.
First I slept, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. I look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Something that set me free, and I'd arrive to a world in harmony. See love as a vision that one day would appear. Promises are.
Take me where the promises are real. The promise.